This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 57. And very excited about today's episode. We're going to be diving into practice. We talk a lot of theory on the show, a lot of talk about books, talk about ideas. And I have the wonderful Dr. Lindsay Hampson on today. And we're going to be diving into practice, specifically the practice of consulting your consultants. And I'm just a big fan of Dr. Hampson. I think you'll come away from this episode also a big fan. She's just one of those people when I'm in conversation with, I just leave feeling like, she's a lot of things I aspire to be. So, and that includes, generous and just a great way of being, just a great way of being. So, and I think that'll all come across in today's episode, and I'm excited to bring it to you today. But before we get there, a quick announcements. I'm going to be doing some stuff in the coming months and would love you to join me. I'm going to be in Denver I got invited back to the Denver Pomo Gathering on April 27th. So if you're in or around Denver, please reach out to me. That would be great. And come join me at the Denver Pomo Gathering on April 27th. There's going to be several great presenters during the day. We're all going to be talking about various types of narrative-related practices. And I don't know exactly what I'm talking about, but I'll figure that out. So, or they might want me to do something. I don't know. But April 27th, Denver Pomo Gathering. And then after that, shortly after that, I will be in Vancouver for TC15, Therapeutic Conversations 15. That's going to be an amazing conference, a couple of different tracks. If you just go to Google Therapeutic Conversations Vancouver, May 1st through 4th, we'll be in Vancouver. My colleague, Justine D'Arrigo-Patrick, who was interviewed on this podcast several episodes back, and I are going to be doing a presentation titled Beyond Deconstruction, and all the information can be found on the website. Go check it out. And then finally, in June, I will be at the AFTA conference, the American Family Therapy Academy conference in Oakland on June 20th through the 22nd, and I'm going to be doing a plenary talk on rupture and repair on the therapeutic relationship, and I'm kind of excited about that and also nervous about it. I'm going to be showing actual video, unedited video, or it will be edited, but a video of me failing in therapy and then trying to clean it up. So just come for that. That in and of itself, I think, is worth it. So I'm excited about that, and it'll hopefully generate some interesting conversations and perspectives. And so anyway, and if you're going to be at any of those places, Denver in April, Vancouver in May, or Oakland in June, please reach out to me, because I'm going to try to pull together a radical therapist gathering if I can get some interest. We did that last year at the Narrative Gathering in San Diego, and that was a lot of fun. We went and grabbed a corner of a restaurant bar and just had some great conversations, and it was a lot of fun. And if you would be interested in doing something like that, please reach out to me, and I'll make it happen. So that would be a lot of fun. Okay, so let's get to our show. Please, if you're interested, go check out the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. Several new videos up. They're also up on the Facebook page. And so go check that out. Go subscribe to the channel. Go check out the videos. Leave a comment. Subscribe to the channel if you're interested. I'm trying to be really regular with some of those videos, and they're fun to make. And hopefully you'll go check them out. So, okay. That's it. Let's get to our guest. Today we're going to be talking about, I first, I don't know how I ran into Dr. Hampson originally, but a longtime listener of the show. We exchanged some emails, have been in conversation about different topics, and ran across her article in Context, the journal Context, titled Lessons Hard Won, An Introduction to the Theory and Applications of Consulting Your Consultants. And I thought it was a great piece to introduce people to the practice of consulting your consultants. And so wanted to at least start there. She's done a lot of other things, but at least start there and on this show. And so so Dr. Lindsay Hampson is a chartered clinical psychologist, systemic family practitioner, and accredited UK ASFP solution-focused practitioner. She has 20 years experience of working as a psychologist, both in the National Health Service and the private sector. She is a visiting lecturer at Lancaster University and Liverpool University Doctorate in Clinical Psychology training courses. She lectures on narrative therapy, solution-focused therapy, and collaborative postmodern systemic therapies. Lindsay currently works in a specialist CAMHS team in Sefton. As an acting assistant clinical lead, she is passionate about providing high-quality, ethical, and collaborative interventions that are respectful and monitored with outcome measures, which I'm probably going to want to have her back on the show to talk about her work around outcome measures as well. But Lindsay is also the co-author of Jake and the Weather Scare, a handbook for healthcare professionals working with children with fears and phobias. She has authored numerous articles on systemic therapies and recently co-edited an issue of Context, the magazine for family therapy and systemic practice in the UK, on measuring change in systemic practice. Lindsay loves sci-fi films, comedy, art deco architecture, a nice glass of whiskey, and RuPaul's Drag Race. So without further ado, let's meet Lindsay. All right. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to the Radical Therapist Podcast.
Hi, Chris.
I'm very excited to have you here. We're doing something a little different, and that's why I'm excited. We're kind of, you know, on this show, we talk a lot of theory and ideas and kind of chew on a lot of that stuff. But here we're going to kind of get down and really look at practice, which I'm excited about that. Or a practice, and then hopefully have you back to maybe talk about some more practices that our listeners can maybe start exploring or experimenting with. But before we do that, I want to start, before we start exploring, what we're going to explore today is the consulting your consultants. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners a bit about the work you do and how you came into narrative practice.
Okay, yeah, no problem, Chris. So I work in a specialist child and adolescent mental health service. We call it CAMHS in the UK. So I work for Sefton CAMHS, and Sefton's a funny bit of the country. It's near Liverpool on the coast. We in Sefton CAMHS, we've got a staff team of approximately 30 therapists, and they're made up of psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health practitioners, and trainee therapists on placement with us. So Sefton CAMHS, it's part of the National Health Service, so it's free at the point of delivery. But we're owned, if you like, by Alderhay Children's NHS Foundation Trust. And Alderhay, I mean, I don't know whether your listeners will be familiar with Alderhay, but it's a big, quite a famous children's hospital in the UK. Mm. So we're owned by them, but we're a community team. So we work out in the community in Waterloo and in Southport. And we offer specialist therapeutic treatments to young people with acute or chronic mental health difficulties from 0 to 18. Mm-hmm. So within the team, I'm currently acting assistant clinical lead. So that involves clinical leadership, supervision, as well as therapeutic interventions and care coordination. So the therapeutic bit that I do within the team, so I deliver cognitive assessments. Some people call that neuropsychology. I don't know what you call that in the States. Mm. I'm a lead therapist and reflecting team member in our family therapy team. And I offer systemic interventions as a solo practitioner as well.
Okay.
I'm also the lead in Sefton for routine outcome measures. So this is kind of a bit of a contentious issue in the UK at the moment. But I know you had Scott Miller on, didn't you?
Yes,
a few months back. So that was really exciting for me. So I'm quite passionate about making sure that we monitor our interventions and making sure they're good quality. And not only the good quality, that the voice of parents, young people and carers is highlighted through the therapeutic process, and that we punctuate our therapeutic process by checking in all the time. Are we going in the direction that you wanted to go in? Let's have a look to see whether your symptoms or whatever way you want to define it, are they changing? Are things getting better? Are things getting worse? So I take a lead on that in my service, and gives us the opportunity to do something different if therapy isn't working. I hope that, I don't know if that's
yeah,
the
no,
kind
that's
thing
great.
That you're...
Yeah, and I have a lot of questions about that. And but actually, narrative practice. How did you fall into the narrative practice?
Well, it's interesting you say fall into, because it was like a process of falling in love. It's been a long and rich process, and it started way back in 1998. So I first met narrative therapy. I was an assistant psychologist in West Lancs, and I don't know what the process is for how clinical psychologists come into being in the States, Chris, but over here in the UK, you graduate with your psychology degree, your undergrad degree. And then if you want to be a clinical psychologist, you've got to get work experience. So the traditional route is to become an assistant psychologist.
Yeah, something similar here, yeah.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. So you're a really junior psychologist. You deliver really closely monitored interventions by your supervisor. You haven't got any formal therapeutic training. So I was lucky enough to have a supervisor who was dual trained in family therapy and clinical psychology. His name is Bruce Law. He's just about to retire, actually. He was a fantastic mentor to me. And he introduced me to family therapy. Mm. And, you know, it was a really pivotal moment, really. I'd come from just an undergraduate degree. So I was being totally immersed in systemic ideas from the get-go. And I was just, he was giving me all his learning materials, and I was just thinking, okay, so this is what clinical psychology is. Mm. But actually, I was being born into systemic practice.
Yeah, right.
So it was fantastic. So I'm often puzzled when people say about you're quite systemic for a clinical psychologist. I always think, I don't know, I've been brought up this way. So I don't know how it is to be anything different. So he in supervision, he mentioned to me externalizing practices, because we were working together with a young boy with really poorly controlled diabetes. And when he was explaining to me about externalizing, I couldn't quite believe it. I couldn't quite believe what he was telling me. Mm. And it just seemed so fun and playful. But I just couldn't muster up the courage to give it a go, because really dominant in the late 90s was CBT.
Yeah, right.
So I was being influenced by cognitive behavioral ideas and systemic ideas. And I think at that point I felt more comfortable with more internalizing ways of interviewing people rather than externalizing. But it kind of held a place in my heart, and then resurfaced again when I got onto the doctorate in clinical psychology. I was in my first year, and luckily enough, the doctorate I was on in clinical psychology is very systemically orientated. So I was having a lot of systemic teaching, and I also had a supervisor who was systemically influenced. So between those two influences, it gave me the courage to actually try and put these ideas into practice. So I was working in a children's hospital in Manchester, and I was seeing a boy with really poorly controlled atopic eczema, and he wasn't using his medications. He was in a really bad way, and his mum was really concerned about him. So I thought, right, okay, perfect. I'm going to give externalizing a go, because I think that's the place where people start with narrative therapy,
yeah,
isn't
sure.
it?
Yeah, right.
Even though you can do narrative therapy without externalizing, when you first get into narrative therapy, yep, you think narrative therapy is externalizing.
I think that's where we all start, right?
Yeah. So I thought, right, I'm going to give this a shot. And this young person, he absolutely hated coming to see me. I could see he was in touch with a lot of guilt and shame over his condition. So I thought, okay, perfect. Let's give this a go. So we started drawing the itch, as we called it, and how big it was at different times of the day. And in maths, he was learning about graphs at school. So we would draw graphs of how big the itch was at certain times of the day. So I was, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I was situating him as expert in his own life.
Right.
What does he know about the itch? What can he tell me about the itch's influence over him? Thankfully, it really paid off because he was really struggling to engage. And I think that, again, that was another instrumental moment for me. I thought, actually, this is quite liberating for some young people. So after that, I think, I wrote up a case study on it, and that further cemented my relationship with the approach.
Hmm.
And then I went to do adult mental health and didn't feel confident using narrative therapy with adults because I think certainly over here, Chris, I don't know about the States, but people think narrative therapy is an approach for children, or, you know, it's a common misconception.
Yeah, I've heard that critique before, right?
But, you know, certainly, you know, I use it with adults, but at that time as a trainee clinical psychologist, I kind of left narrative therapy for a bit and returned to it in my third year. And in our third year in clinical training, we get to specialise, as they call it. So I chose to specialise in family therapy. And I was really, really lucky because, I had a dual-trained supervisor. And she was doing her supervisor's training in family therapy. So I was getting live supervision through the earbud. I was doing two family therapy clinics a week, as well as doing interventions as a solo practitioner. So she would give me feedback in the earbud. She would, because she was doing her qualification, she'd give me really long and detailed summaries of my clinical sessions. Mm. And they were so, so detailed, and I got a lot from them. And they were very clearly theory practice links. She was really passionate about that, about where you situate yourself. How do you know what's orientating you at this time?
Yeah.
And so I was trying all different systemic hats on at the time, a bit of post-Milan, a bit of structural, a bit of strategic. But she said to me that I was at my most interventive and my most authentic when I was using narrative therapy.
Wow. Yeah.
So it felt like, you know, this approach was knocking on the door again. And after she said, I've got a very strong relationship with praise, Chris. So if someone says I'm good at something, you know, I tend to throw myself into it. So that was a real mirror to the self. Okay, this is who I am. Maybe this is who I am, a therapist who situates herself narratively. So after that, if it moved, I'd externalize it. So I remember using it with a boy who was getting into trouble at school, with a young person with chronic fatigue, with a young person with anorexia. And I just embraced it and immersed myself in it. Mm. And then that just grew and grew. I got a bit unstuck when I qualified as a clinical psychologist because I felt really passionate about non-expert empowering approaches, postmodern approaches. But the team that I found myself in seemed to be very organized by CBT and by psychiatry at the time.
Mm.
And as a recently qualified therapist, I was trying to find my own voice. Whereas previously I'd always, I don't know, tried to slot myself into the voice of my supervisor.
Mm.
To kind of, you know, you try their shoes on, you see whether they're comfy.
Yeah.
Right. You decide whether you're going to leave those shoes behind or whether there's part of you that wants to walk in those shoes for a bit. But in the absence of any kind of narrative influences in that team, I was working out how to situate myself, and CBT was big. There was a CBT supervision group that was quite influential at the time. And, you know, I was interested in CBT. I have been interested in CBT at different points in my life. I found it a really helpful therapy. But I was struggling to understand how I could be both of those things, how I could do cognitive approaches, but how I could be post-structural. How could I hold both those philosophies? Mm. It created a lot of intra-psychic tension for me.
Sure, yeah.
Because I felt like I was betraying narrative therapy by embracing those approaches. And how collaborative was I being if I was holding expert knowledge? So I started then to try and look for commonalities between approaches, as well as acknowledging differences. So narrative and CBT come from very different philosophical origins.
For sure.
But they've got commonalities.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but keep seeing these commonalities. So in order to create my own comfort as a new therapist, I started to integrate them. And actually, my first experience of consulting your consultants was by integrating CBT and narrative therapy with a young boy who was afraid of the weather. Mm. I called him Jake. It's not his real name, but I was really struck by how he was able to take back his life from the weather scares, as he called them, that we wrote a handbook together about how to do that. So not just about the weather, about any scare that's influential in your life. And actually, I went on to publish that workbook in 2010.
Wow.
And I still use it to this day. And people often write to me and they've used the workbook and tell me about how it's moved their lives. And it's interesting because Jake saw me when he was 10. And then he came back into contact with me when he was 16. Mm. And he came with a different problem. He'd been attacked. So he was traumatized. He was 16 years old at this point. And I brought out Jake and the weather scare. And I said, do you remember this handbook that we created together? And he was like, oh my God, that's boss. And that's Liverpool slang for amazing. And even though he was a really cool 16-year-old, the effect that this workbook had on him, seeing it again when he was 16 years old, and he'd say to me, this is still helping people, isn't it, Lindsay? And I'd be like, it absolutely is. And I'd maybe tell him a few stories about how it was helping people. Mm. So that from then on, I trained him a narrative level 1 and narrative level 2 over here in the UK with Hugh Fox.
Oh, yeah.
And went on to start lecturing in narrative therapy.
Mm.
And narrative therapy has created a lot of exciting opportunities for me to publish articles and present at conferences and publish workbooks and now be on this podcast. So it continues to shape my life in loads of exciting ways.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that's a great segue into actually my next question. That story was beautiful. And let's talk about the practice. So you wrote a great piece in the journal Context, which I'll try to link somehow, I think, in the show notes for the listeners. But it's titled Lessons Hard Won, An Introduction to the Theory and Applications of Consulting Your Consultants, which detailed the practice of consulting your consultants. And I'm wondering if you'd share for our listeners unfamiliar with the practice, what is consulting your consultants?
You know, it's really interesting, Chris, because when that article came out, one of my friends who's very narratively influenced, she said she sent me a message saying, you know, it's one of those narrative practices that people don't often talk about. And yeah. I was wondering why that is, that people don't often use consulting your consultants. And I was thinking maybe it's because it is quite a time-hungry process.
Yeah.
But I'll say a little bit about what it involves. So Consulting Your Consultants it was created by Michael White and David Epstein, and it's seen as part of the reauthoring process. So I know quite a lot of your listeners will probably be familiar with the reauthoring process, but is it worth me, Chris, just saying briefly about what reauthoring is?
Yeah.
So reauthoring is Well, I suppose it comes from the idea that when a person experiences a problem in their life, it's because something that's important to them is being transgressed in some way. So it's about connecting people with things that are important to them, those values, intentions, principles, commitments that they stand for in the world that are currently being subjugated in some way. So a reauthoring conversation is about strengthening someone's connection with those things and increasing their visibility so that people can embrace them in taking their lives forward. So it's not just a lens to reinterpret the past. It's the stories that we live by. It's a constitutive process. It organises us. It organises our living as we move forward into the future. So consulting your consultants comes from a storytelling tradition. So it invites people to tell their story from a point of triumph over adversity. And then it allows them to project that story into the future if it continues to take that much influence in a person's life. So what I really like about consulting your consultants is it places the person as the protagonist in their own story, or as the hero in their own story, as Bill O'Hanlon calls it. And I really like that idea about how you can interview people on those lessons hard won, about how they managed to take their life back from the problem and all the things that were critical and instrumental in that process. It fits with the narrative notion of taking it back practice by Michael White. And the acknowledgement that therapy is a two-way process, it actually changes the therapist as well as the person.
Yeah.
So it equalizes the power differential, or you know, as much as possible.
Yeah, at least it equalizes the power.
It strives to do that as much as you can. That the therapist's life will be different on account of their conversations with the person at the center of therapy, and not only that, the therapist will take that learning like a thread. And they'll use that learning to help the families that they work with in the future who may be experiencing something similar. So it's a way of collecting, documenting, and circulating knowledge from the person at the center of therapy, from their lessons hard won, and the therapist, with the person's consent, can then share that knowledge with others in a similar situation.
So why would a clinician new to the practice want to take on this practice in their work? And I know you've told some stories, but I'm wondering if you can maybe say a little something about, you did say it can be time hungry, but there's just so much that can come from this practice. I'm wondering if you'd say a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm sure that one of the big benefits is this sense of fair exchange, that it distributes power more equally across the therapeutic relationship. And why wouldn't we want to do that? That's, you know, it's a really ethical place to stand. Not only that, one of the difficulties that we can get in systemic work is we can do some great work with a family and then, say, school maybe still hold an old narrative about that young person. So the young person makes these new discoveries, takes these big strides with their own family, then goes to school, and school is still captured by an old narrative about them. So what consulting your consultants can do is you can actually invite people to, you can consult the person, but who do we need to circulate this news of change to? Yeah. And I've often invited people from school to sit in on your consultant interview, because actually they need to be caught up on these new knowledges and commitments, or rediscovered knowledges and commitments. So a nice little story was working with a family, and there was a young person who was, you know, they'd been captured by anxiety for a long, long time in their life. And they were a young person who even as a baby, wasn't expected to survive. but overcame the odds, did all the things that the doctors wouldn't say that she'd be able to do. But unfortunately, the paediatrician at the time, a very, very well-meaning paediatrician, felt that this young person would be in and out of mental health services throughout their life. Mm. So I felt that paediatrician, because that paediatrician was going to be in that young person's life because they had physical health problems, I felt that they needed to be caught up on this news of change. So we invited the paediatrician into our goodbye interview at the end, our consultant's interview.
Nice.
So we could catch them up on that. And it took a lot of courage, actually, because I've never done that before. So I was thinking, oh my God, what's the paediatrician going to make of this?
How's this going to go?
Yeah, she absolutely loved it. Oh, wow. So that gave me the courage and my convictions really to carry on. So it can help circulate that news of change so that young people meet more appreciative audiences as they go about their life, more receptive audiences, audiences that might meet them with seeing their intentions, even though they're not, maybe there might be a few blips along the way. Hmm. But not only that, consultants' interviews acknowledge and document resources, competencies, and lessons hard won, key moments and rules of living. And if you take the time to create a therapeutic document from that conversation, it provides a resource that families can call upon again in times of hardship. Mm. And for those that receive the document, so as I said before, you can then circulate that document with the family's permission to people experiencing similar difficulties. So for those people who receive the document or receive those insights, they get to benefit from the knowledge that of someone who's overcome the influence of these difficulties in their life. So in this way, local knowledge gives hope and a sense of connectedness and reduces the isolation in that they become part of a wider community. Mm. So just to give you like a real life example of that. So a few years ago when I was doing my systemic training, I had a health problem which wasn't serious at the time, but could have been serious if it went untreated. And, you know, it's hard to share those sorts of things with people. And I told a friend of mine about it, and she'd actually been through the same process. So we formed this little club where we'd talk about the medical procedures and the horribleness of it and our fears, our hopes. And we'd make like really horrible bad jokes about it. Mm. You know, really kind of gruesome graveyard humor type jokes about it. Mm. And if anyone had said those things to me other than her, I would have told them where to go. But because she'd been through the same process, it was really irreverent. Mm. And it is such a sense of relief and connectedness. Mm. That I thought this is what some psychological literature calls normalization. This is why people suggest group work,
right?
Because it's that sense of connectedness. You know, you're not alone with this, you're not isolated.
Right.
So I think in that sense, consulting your consultants creates a community.
That's great.
And it's, you know, that sense of community is long known transformative process. The final benefit, I think, Chris, is, well, there's two more benefits. One is it gives you more ideas to use with families.
Yeah, right.
But the other one is that it gives a point of entry into the not yet said, as Peter Rober calls it. Mm. So it might be that you've got a therapeutic hunch about something. So, for example, I had a therapeutic hunch with a family that I was working with that the young person who'd experienced domestic violence might have an overly developed threat system. So I think Arlene Viterre calls it mini radars, that you pick up on signs of relational threat. Mm. You become very sensitive to it. So I had a hypothesis that might be happening for the young person, but it was in the not yet said. So I kind of shared my experience with another family and said, I don't know, I get the feeling that this might be happening for you. And this family have told me about these kind of mini radars that get set up between them and their parents about signs of relational signs of threat. I don't know whether that happens between the two of you. And it was, they were then able to talk about their hypervigilance with each other. Mm. So that was a really kind of liberating conversation. So that then became put on the table for discussion. So that's a definite undeniable advantage of consulting your consultants.
That's great. All right, so you've made a great case for the practice. And now I'm wondering, for our listeners, they're probably all wondering, okay, so how do I do this? So I guess, can you run us through possible ways that this can be done in actual practice?
Yeah, there's several ways it can be done. So I'll just go through a bit of a list of how it can be done. But great. Just to say that playful approaches to serious problems is a fantastic resource for consulting your consultants' interviews.
Yeah,
brilliant. So, you know, it's a really good starting point if people are interested in these practices. So one of the ways that consulting your consultants can be done is through this idea of communities of concern. So communities of concern is a practice where the expertise of people facing difficulties are circulated and available to communities of people struggling with the same problem. So David Epstein has the Anti-Anorexia League
right.
on his website. I created a league called the League Against Upsets After Divorce or Family Change in 2006. There's a league against that. There's a community concern about addiction. And these are added, so these are evolving bodies of knowledge that are added to as people contribute to those communities of concern. Mm. So you can set up your own community of concern and add people's experiences to it. Or you can use a handbook approach. So some famous examples of handbooks. So the handbooks are a discrete body of knowledge that a person or a group have generated about ways that they've actively resisted the influence of the problem in their life. Mm. So handbooks have been applied to areas such as sexual abuse. So Hillier in 2001. Generated a handbook. I think it was called The Outrageous Adventurers. And Fears and Phobias. So I produced Jake and the Weather Scare in 2010. And then more recently, there was Losing a Loved One to Suicide, which was Sather and Newman in 2015. So these are discrete bodies of knowledges that you can then share with a person who is new to negotiating the territory of overcoming the influence of the problem. There's also co-research, and David Epstein is big on using this idea of co-research. So this is a way of collaborating and inviting people of various cultures and backgrounds to interpret and study their own lives. So in this way, the researcher and participants become partners, and the Dulwich Centre's got a great resource, 2004, on co-research. Mm. And so I think it's been done with respiratory disease by David Epstein in 1999, anorexia, again, David Epstein, dystrophic amaurosis bullosa, David Epstein again in 2004, and researching people's experience in narrative therapy and the contribution they bring to the therapeutic process, and that was Amanda Redston in 2004. So there's some of the different ways of doing it. But the way that I like to practically do it is by conducting an interview. And I don't know whether to talk about that now, Chris, or whether to talk about that when you ask me about what's been my experience of taking on these practices. Because I guess there's an overlap about ways of doing it and the ways that I've done it. I don't know
I'd be interested in what do you do practically? I like that idea.
Okay. Yeah. So what do I do practically? So my thinking about consulting your consultants interviews has changed over the years. But the place that I started was through looking in playful approaches to serious problems. And they suggest interviewing the family or the young person as if you're an investigative journalist. and approaching it as if you're a journalist interviewing the young person on their latest discoveries, their latest triumphs. So what I ask the young person about, because I predominantly work with young people, is who's their hero? So it might be a sports person, it might be a pop star, it might be an actor. And I ask them about, have they ever had any experiences where they've seen the hero being interviewed? They might be, and they often say that they have. And I might ask them to tell me a story about that. And I say, well, how do you fancy if I interview you about your latest developments? Because you've taken so much of your life back from the problem that I do think it'd be really helpful for other people in a similar situation to benefit from that. Would you be interested in that conversation? Mm. And more often than not, I don't think I've had anyone turn me down yet. Yeah. And whether that's because it's appealing or whether it's a power differential, I'm not totally sure. But they often seem quite keen to do that. So what I do then is I ask them about who might be important to catch up on these new developments, and they might say learning mentors or teachers or members of school staff or family members. Mm. So we invite them to be part of the audience. So I do brief the audience about the process as well. So I use a scaffold of questions that's developed over the years. And my most recent scaffold guides the process of the conversation, but I can move about in different places on the scaffold, like any narrative scaffold. So I tend to start with the past in a consultant scaffold. Mm. So I interview the young person about the problem or the previous state of affairs, its impact, its ways of operating, the effects on the person, and the effects on people close to the person as well. So I say, what was it like? How was it acting on you? What was the problem talking other people into about you? Mm. How was it having other people act around you? So I asked them about all the different ways the problem was impacting on their life. And then I asked them about the key actions, the key advice, the key reawakenings or awakenings in themselves or others in influencing the problem, and the difference it made to themselves and others in various domains in their life, like on their identity, on their mood, on their spirits, on their body, on their relationships, on their interactions, on their opportunities, on their dreams, etc. So that might, a question like that might look like, so what were the key realizations that had you taking a different approach to anxieties, influence in your life? What were some of the key experiences that reawakened you to that you could gain some influence over this? Mm. And what did those key awakenings do for your sense of who you were? What did those key events have on your mood, on your spirits? How did those key events affect others around you, and what effect did their actions have as a result of those key awakenings? What effect did that have on you? So that's one. So I can investigate certain areas more than others. So for example, if a person, if it's led to certain physical health problems, I might dive more deeply into that area. Mm. And then I bring it into the present and think about what actions, advice, events, and awakenings in themselves or others that it's producing in the here and now. And how has life been moved or transported as a result of this? Mm. And then I ask them about the difference that that makes to themselves and others in terms of, again, going back to Hugh Fox's identity state intentional categories of how it affects their identity. Oh, sorry, no, it's not Hugh Fox intentional state identity categories. You'll have to edit that bit, Chris.
No, we'll leave it in. That's all right.
It's statement's position map one. So thinking about actually one and two, identity, mood, spirits, body, relationships, interactions, opportunities, dreams. goals, triumphs, status, all those different categories of inquiry. So a question from the present might look like, so in realizing that people treated you differently when you stepped into confidence, what effect did that have? What effect does that have in the here and now on some of your actions when you take on new initiatives?
That's great. And I just want to acknowledge, I really appreciate you sharing those questions with our listeners. And I don't think we do enough of that. I just want to acknowledge that. I really appreciate you doing that. Sometimes we, I don't know, we hold that stuff secret, I guess. And that is,
yeah, precious knowledge.
Yeah. Or that, you know, just, they come from someplace and I don't know, but I just really appreciate you sharing those questions. So thank you. And that's going to be the part of the podcast where everybody pauses and writes them down and then pauses and then writes them down again. So thanks for that, Lindsay.
So the scaffold then goes into the future, because what we want to do is to make sure that the effects of consulting your consultants carries forward in the young person's life and resonates, and they're able to hold it close to them as they grow up, as they enter the world of education or enter the world of work or have their own family. So the scaffold then jumps to, and it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to go into this order, but I sometimes do it linearly like this, but sometimes jump between it.
Sure.
But it tends to make more sense to me to do it in this kind of linear way. So if you think about the future, what impact on the direction of the future will all these realizations have? Will these initiatives have? How does the young person predict that their life will continue to be transported? What it might make possible that wouldn't have happened before in their life?
Yeah, I love those questions.
I love those questions too.
Yeah.
And then asking the young person or family, it doesn't have to be a young person, about the key actions or self-advice that they want to keep giving themselves in order to hold close and to continue to embrace preferred ways of being. And to ask them, this comes from Stephen Madigan, I think. Mm. If the older unwanted ways try and make a reappearance as a seasoned veteran, what could you see yourself doing with all this experience behind you?
That's great.
Yeah. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
Final stage of the interview is the bit that I like to share with other families, which is, so for yourself and for others at the beginning of the journey, what might you have wanted to know that would be helpful to catch others up on?
Right.
Does that benefit me as a therapist? Because I don't know, you know, I haven't had the lived experience, you know, I might have some commonalities with these young people, but I don't know what it's like to be a boy whose dad is no longer has contact with you.
Right.
I don't know what it's like to be a young person who survived through domestic violence. So I want to know about those things for the next time I work with young people and families in that situation. So I will say things like in the recommendations section of the interview. So for me and other therapists, what things did we do together that were helpful and what things were overlooked? And what might those recommendations make possible for other families, for all those who are working with them?
That's great. Okay. What are some of the, I know you've kind of touched on some of these, but what are some of the relational ethics we should be considering if we're going to be taking up these practices?
Well, as I said before, there is a resource hungry approach, because you've got to, if you're going to do a consultant's interview, you have to invite people, you have to brief them, you have to take time to, you know, I work in the National Health Service and you don't get a spare minute. Right. So to actually write letters inviting people to special meetings is really difficult. And it could be so easy just to go, oh, we'll just have the family in on this. Right. So what I try and do, because I do think it's a very ethical practice consulting your consultants. So what I try and do is to create templates that I can draw forward. So I can make sure that I've got little shortcuts that I can turn to, like sample letters that I can use to invite people to the process. Not only that, but when you've circulated the knowledge of a young person, so with the League Against Upsets of Divorce and Family Change, I had to keep checking back with young people that they were happy for their testimonies to be on that community of concern. Now, that takes time. You also have to negotiate with the family about how do they wish to be known if you are going to circulate that knowledge. Do they want a pseudonym? Some people don't want a pseudonym. Some people want to be referred by their first name, and that's fine. But I think you've got to also temper that with explaining to the young person, how might you feel in 5 years' time if you're using, you know, some people, young people might say, I want to use my full name. But you might say, you know, how might you feel? And it's not to kind of scare them off that process, but it's just, you know, it might feel right now, but let's kind of project this into the future. How can you imagine that feeling as you grow up and this knowledge still being out there? But you've also got to be open to the fact that the young person might change their mind, and then that knowledge has to be taken down. So community of concern are often online. So you've got to be prepared at any point to withdraw, or withdraw the wrong word, but to editorialise at points in the process. The final document, if it's going to be circulated, has to be thoroughly clarified and consented to in its final form. So I make sure you're happy with these words, you're happy with these pictures, you're happy with the way it's phrased. So we agree it all in its final form. And again, you've got to keep checking back with the young person. Are you still happy for this to be a live process? I think I've been really lucky. All the families I've worked with have been really generous with their knowledge. They're really happy for their heroism to continue to be acknowledged, and for their lives to touch the lives of others. But you've got to be prepared as well that by sharing knowledge of someone who's triumphed against the difficulty, is that a welcome knowledge to another person at the start of therapy? So I don't know about you, Chris, but there's been certain times in my life where I've been having a crappy time and someone's told me about a person, a friend of mine, she had that and she's fine now. I think, oh, great for them. I'm not great. Going through this crappy time.
I just did a video on cheerleading on the YouTube channel.
I watched it. I actually loved it.
And it takes up some of those effects.
So I you've got to be really careful, and so you've got to be tentative in offering that person's knowledge and say, look, there's a young person I've worked with. They managed to take back their life from the influence of a similar difficulty. Would you be interested in that right now? Or is that maybe for a time in the future? Because it can strengthen a person's connection with loss. If it comes at the wrong time, it can strengthen their connection with abject misery. Like I said, you know, well, that's great for them, but I'm really suffering right now. So it's really important that you check that they're in a place to receive the wisdom of others, and it connects them with hope rather than despair.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so we're getting close to ending, and I guess I didn't get at everything I wanted to ask you, but I have a couple of final questions for you, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
What is capturing your attention these days? I guess I'm always interested in what's capturing other, you know, folks' attention these days, and that could be ideas, books, ways of working. What are you chewing on these days?
Oh, tons at the moment. So I'm really captured by nonviolent resistance at the moment. I think that in our culture, we're more comfortable with internalizing difficulties than externalizing difficulties. So what I mean by that is low mood, anxiety, and we're less comfortable with acting out, you know, what sometimes is referred to in the UK as conduct disorder. I mean, I'm really uncomfortable with that phrase. So what's been capturing my attention is this idea in nonviolent resistance about connection rather than correction. So I really like ideas from nonviolent resistance about trying to connect with the young person before you enter some kind of disciplinary mode with them. Mm. And that really fits with me with the ideas from domain theory, in that sometimes conduct difficulties, if we just call them that for brevity's sake at the moment, mm-hmm. Invite carers and parents to locate themselves in a educational or a corrective domain, when actually that young person, especially if it's a young man, they might be really, really hurting. And, you know, one of your videos on patriarchy, Chris, talks about there's two options for men and boys, silence or anger.
Yeah, right.
And I take that with me everywhere, because I think, you know, are we only comfortable with women's distress? Are we comfortable with the men's distress? Of course, some of the way that men express their distress can be awful and horrendous. But how do we get people to see that actually some of these young men are wanting a connection, the hurt, they're not being, you know, we need to come at it from a nurture discipline rather than a correction. A nurture domain rather than a correction domain. And that also has been influenced my thinking about, I've become really interested in attachment, the intersection of attachment and systemic theory.
Okay.
I know you've got a certain position on that, Chris.
No, I'm, that's interesting. I love those points of tension though. I like.
Well, I've really got into it recently because I think because I've been trying it out and it's been having some kind of effect on my work. So I'm really loving Rudy Dalos' attachment narrative therapy ideas. And
which you introduced me to, and I need to pick up and spend some time with. But yeah, you did introduce me to it. Yeah,
it's absolutely great. And attachment-based family therapy, Diamond Levy. So that intersection where some a rupture happens at some point in, and it might be early on. It might be that a rupture is kind of revisited later on. Those small T's and big T's that mean there's relational ruptures, and that young people can't turn to their carers for support. So it ends up coming out in either kind of angry ways or internalized, you know, low mood, anxiety. So I've been working on really simple metaphors, but making metaphors concrete so that theoretical assumptions become really easy for people to understand, turning it into concrete tasks. So that's something that I've been working quite a lot with recently. And, you know, recently I've become really oriented back to Carl Tom's ethical postures. I think being in this kind of acting up clinical leadership role has meant that I'm kind of supervising a lot of people, but I'm also in a lot of forums that I haven't previously been in. And there's lots of ways that you can be influential. And some people who come to supervision talk to me about wanting to confront injustices in the system. So they want to take that confrontational, and, you know, confrontational is an ethical posture, absolutely.
Right.
You know, there's a place for I think because it's called confrontation, sometimes people feel uncomfortable with it. But I think what Carl Tom meant is it's closing down options rather than it being directly confrontational. But some people want to adopt a confrontational posture, and I've been trying to encourage them to see different ethical postures as ways to be influential in team meetings, in meetings with the systems around children, and how that can be beneficial. And I think Carl Tom talks a bit about we become more comfortable with certain ethical postures because of our training. So because of my narrative background, I'm very comfortable with the empowering posture. But John Burnham came, I was really lucky that John Burnham is really kind of influential family therapist in the UK, came to observe one of my sessions because he was giving someone feedback who was on the supervisor's course. And he said to me, don't be afraid of the other ethical postures. Sometimes you can be strategic and that's an absolutely ethical posture. Sometimes you can step into succulence. That's an ethical posture. Mm. So he has connected with me of different ways I can orientate myself in different spheres of my working life. Mm. And it's been really invigorating.
Yeah. And I think it all speaks to, you know, kind of embracing complexity, right? And
absolutely.
And those points of tension. And you have me thinking about what's been really interesting to me, obviously, is, you know, post-oppositional practice and some of these other ways, you know, Anna Louise Keating's work. And you just have me thinking about those ideas as well. And so I appreciate anybody that's, I just appreciate that embracing complexity.
A lot of richness and complexity, isn't there?
Yeah, it's just, we don't do it really well. I have to speak to myself sometimes. You know, it's hard to do and it's hard to teach and train and, you know, but I think it's what's needed now, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I know people are going to be interested in you and your work. And how would people find you and get in touch with you and get exposed to your work?
Okay, so in anticipation of this podcast, I've actually created a website.
Wonderful.
I feel a bit of an imposter in doing that, but it's www.lindseyhampson, and that's lindseyhampson.wordpress.com, and it's just a place where I've put all the articles I've written over the years, and you know, it's a place where I've been a psychologist in one form or another for 20 years, and things always seem to come full circle. So it's a place where I've put resources I've generated on there. There's a consultant, your consultant scaffold on there that I've put on. Because I think, you know, we live in busy times, Chris, and things are always circular. And it might be that I can save someone a bit of time. I've written a PowerPoint presentation about something that someone could benefit from.
That's great.
So all my articles are on there. I've got my first ever meditation is on there, where I've integrated narrative therapy with compassion-focused therapy. Hmm. And I'm using that a lot with our staff teams at the moment, about starting our team meetings with compassion-focused exercises, because I think we can sometimes make decisions out of threat rather than out of compassion. So that's been quite influential. So there's a meditation on there. So I'm hoping to update the website every couple of weeks with something from my past. Great. And hopefully from things from the present and the future. But if there's a contact me form, if anyone wants to get in touch. And I love hearing from people. I really do. Hmm. It's really sustaining. So yeah, get in touch. I'll absolutely love it.
Hmm. Yeah. And I'd pay a visit just for the scaffolding questions that you've made available to everybody. That's very generous of you, so thank you for that. Yeah, and I will link it on the show notes so you can access it easily. And I just want to say, Lindsay, this is a long time coming. Thank you very much for making the time. Can't wait to have you back if that's okay.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, and just thank you for making the time, Lindsay. It was a wonderful conversation.
It's really sustaining, because I'm a long time listener. And to actually be invited to share knowledge is a really sustaining process.
Wonderful.
For me as well.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. And as always, thank you for listening. And just a quick reminder, go to the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. Check out the new videos that are up. And if you're so inclined, please subscribe and like them. That would be great. Or even share them with people you think might be interested in them. That would be wonderful. We could always use your support if you're still listening to the show at this point to leave us a review or rate or review the show on iTunes. I understand that helps us get out and about. So please do that. And if you have any questions for me or want to reach out, I love to hear from listeners. Just reach out to me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And you can find The Radical Therapist on all social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of that. So just search us out and find us. That'd be great. And as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. Thanks for listening.